1,800 alpha dogs have been sold. The hunt has found favor with a large group of fans, especially children and technology geeks. The developers hope to equip future models with the ability to bark so their product would look more lifelike.
Cheese goes well with food items indeed, especially on the breakfast table in almost every home. But have you ever tested halloumi? The rubbery cheese I'm talking about from Cyprus, which now gets EU protected status. Halloumi is a traditional homemade item in Cyprus, with historical accounts suggesting its production as early as the 16th century, believe it or not. Now, the salty cheese is the country's second most valuable export. In Turkish, it is known as helin. Europe has now decided to recognize halloumi, called white gold by dairy farmers, as a unique thing to be divided in eastern Mediterranean island there. Locals usually enjoy it tossed in the frying pan or barbecued, eaten raw with melon in the summer, or cubed and thrown into be boiled with soup.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Calls grow for U.S. President Joe Biden to end all U.S. support for Saudi Arabia, which is preventing food, medicine, fuel, and other aid from reaching starving Yemenis. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is titled Calls mount for Biden to end U.S. complicity in starvation of Yemen. Here's more on this issue. A strike launched by Detroit-based anti-war activists in protest of the Saudi-led blockade of Yemen entered its 17th day on Wednesday, April 14th, as calls grow for U.S. President Joe Biden to end all U.S. support for the kingdom's deadly restrictions, which are preventing food, medicine, fuel, and other aid from reaching starving Yemenis. Iman Saleh, a 26-year-old Yemeni-American taking part in the hunger strike, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed recently that the siege against Yemen not only has had a crippling effect on everyday life, but it is also compounding the ongoing conflict in the country, causing damage that exceeds even the violence itself in both scale and intensity. After days without food, I have lost much of my short-term memory. Day in and day out, I feel the physical burden of starvation that my people have endured for so long. But my pain cannot amount to that of Yemenis under siege, Saleh continued. I am starving, but I'm not being starved. I'm suffering, but I can choose to end that suffering, she added. Saleh and other members of the Yemeni liberation movement are demanding that Biden immediately cut off U.S. support for the Saudi blockade and pressure Riyadh to lift the restrictions. In February, Biden vowed to end U.S. assistance for all of the Saudi-led coalition's offensive operations in Yemen. But the president has been quiet on the blockade, which one analyst characterized as an offensive military operation that kills civilians. As Saleh and her fellow activists have rallied in the nation's capital in recent days to demand action from the Biden administration, a growing cohort of Democrats in Congress is showing solidarity with the hunger strikers and pressuring the White House to do everything in its power to bring about an end to the devastating land, air, and sea blockade. I do hope that those who are watching realize that the longer that you are all on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen, Representative Ilhan Omar said in an emotional speech to demonstrators in Washington, D.C. recently. In a report released earlier this year, several United Nations agencies warned that 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could die of starvation this year without urgent humanitarian help as their country is ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic, strangled by the blockade, and bombarded by airstrikes from the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed coalition. The World Food Program estimated that 50,000 Yemenis are facing famine-like conditions, with 5 million a mere step away from this worst-case scenario. A further 11 million people are facing crisis levels of food insecurity, the organization said. In 2021, around half of all children under 5 in Yemen, that is about 2.3 million, are projected to face acute malnutrition. The people of Yemen are without water, without food, without electricity, Representative Jamal Bauman said in a video posted to Twitter. A child is dying every 75 seconds. Half of the country is starving because of the Saudi Arabian blockade. We need for Saudi Arabia to immediately lift the blockade and allow food and aid into Yemen. Every nation should be standing up and speaking out. President Biden, please demand that the Saudis lift the blockade and let us bring aid into Yemen, Bauman continued. People are starving, children are dying, and it's on us to do more and do better, he added. Yara Baden, an activist taking part in the hunger strike, echoed that message in an interview with Middle East Eye. At the end of the day, who is paying? It's the innocent people in Yemen who have nothing to do with anything that's happening, Baden said of the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed war on Yemen, which began in 2015. And we are complicit. The United States is complicit. In the same February speech in which he pledged to end all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, Biden also said that we are going to continue to support and help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and its territorial integrity and its people. As Vox Alex Watt reported recently, some analysts believe Riyadh took that as implicit support for the blockade, even as the Biden administration has consistently expressed the free flow of fuel and goods into Yemen is critical. That may partly explain why Saudi Arabia has kept the restrictions in place, Ward noted. In March, for instance, CNN found that Saudi warships had kept all oil tankers from docking in port of Hodeidah since the start of the year. In a letter to Biden recently, nearly 80 House Democrats led by Representatives Rakana, Debbie Dingell, and Mark Pocan implored the president to use all available U.S. leverage with the Saudi regime to demand an immediate and unconditional end to its blockade, which threatens 16 million malnourished Yemenis living on the brink of famine. The Saudi blockade has long been a leading driver of Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe, triggering recent fuel shortages, inflation, and greatly reducing access to food, water, electricity, and transportation, the lawmakers wrote. Every day that we wait for these issues to be resolved in negotiations is another day that pushes more children to the brink of death.
It was on Sunday when Iran's nuclear facilities in the central city of Natanz came under another Israeli attack. Israeli media cited intelligence sources as saying it was an Israeli cyber attack. Former Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Moshe Yalon said he hopes no one in Israel would take responsibility for the Natanz incident implicitly. Yalon said there are things for which silence is always beautiful. Spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Behrouz Kamalvandi, said the incident affected part of the electricity distribution network of Natanz. He said the attack caused no casualties or contamination, adding that investigations are underway into the matter. Iran's nuclear chief also reacted. Ali Akbar Salehi condemned the incident as an act of nuclear terrorism. He said the futile and desperate enemy move was aimed at blocking Iran's eye-catching nuclear progress. He called on the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency to respond to the act of terror. Iran's foreign ministry also accused Israel of being the culprit behind the cyber attack on the Natanz nuclear facility, pledging that Tehran will take revenge. Foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh slammed the Israeli sabotage act as an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity.
Khatibzadeh said Iran reserves the right to respond in kind under Article 51 of the UN Charter. The spokesman noted that Tehran has started communications with international authorities in this regard. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz will not slow down Iran's nuclear program and will instead speed up the country's nuclear advancement. He said the centrifuges damaged in the incident were the IR-1 type and that they will be replaced with the most advanced centrifuges Iran has developed. The attack on the Natanz nuclear facility happens on the same day the U.S. Defense Secretary visits Israel for the first time in his capacity.
As a major strategic partner for the United States, our bilateral relationship with Israel in particular is central to regional stability and security in the Middle East. During our meeting, I reaffirmed to Minister Gantz, our commitment to Israel is enduring and it is ironclad.
For many, the visit might be carrying a message.
One has to assume, especially while the defense secretary is visiting Israel, because it would be hugely embarrassing. So the assumption has to be that the U.S. knew this attack was going to take place and did not say not to do it. Otherwise, there would have to be some kind of a protest by the United States to the Israeli government for doing it.
The attack on Natanz nuclear facility is not the first act of terror by the Israeli regime against the Islamic Republic. A blast hit a centrifuge assembly line at Natanz July last year, which Iran described as an act of sabotage. head of the Israeli agency Yossi Cohen told the New York Times then that Israel had detonated a bomb there. In November 2020, prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran. This, as his name was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear energy program. Netanyahu described the scientist as a director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, quote, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. Apart from Fakhrizadeh, a number of other Iranian scientists have fallen victim to the Israeli terrorism. Either Shir Hosseinpour, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Daryush Rezai Nejad, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan are all on that list. But as far as the Natanz attack is concerned, it came a day after Iran started up several cascades of advanced centrifuges in the facility. The incident also comes at a time when Tehran is holding talks with the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are aimed at removing the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, for Israel to do it at this time, the assumption, again, would be that they're trying to mess up those negotiations and make it hard for the United States to come to an agreement with Iran. You know, it'll be harder for the U.S., I imagine, to go back by taking off the sanctions.
All in all, what is almost certain is the fact that Israel will leave no stone unturned to hamper Iran's nuclear advancements by carrying out such acts of terrorism. The regime also tries its best to prevent the United States from reaching a deal with the Islamic Republic to remove the sanctions that have crippled the lives of millions of Iranians. But many are also pointing the finger at the U.S. in the case of the Natanz Sabotage Act and other terrorist attacks by the Israeli regime, arguing Israel doesn't commit such acts of terror without Washington's blessing.
A group of activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
But what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis? During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon. But even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as a U.S. vice president in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapon sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia is soon to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
The latest round of talks on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, ended in Vienna on Friday. The Austrian capital hosted 4 days of talks between delegates from Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal to revitalize the agreement. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with them. Tehran and Washington remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. While the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, so far it has refused to remove sanctions. The U.S. says it is prepared to lift sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA. While it has declined to elaborate, that appears to exclude sanctions formally related to nuclear issues covered by the deal. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear accord. As the first round of negotiations finished on Friday, the participants agreed to hold another round of talks next Wednesday in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are going to be about removal of sanctions and nuclear implementation of the deal.
We know that Trump's maximum pressure campaign failed against Iran. And Iran has emerged with an economy more resistant to external pressure and so insulated from the U.S. sanctions.
China has said the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally and remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from 2015 nuclear deal as the root cause of the crisis. During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA by calling it a weak agreement. Then Washington used the maximum pressure campaign to wage an economic war on Tehran to force it to renegotiate. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif previously said that unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. inflicted $1 trillion worth of damage on Iran's economy. He said Iran expects compensation after Washington rejoins the accord. A senior U.S. State Department official has predicted if Tehran insists on the removal of all sanctions imposed since 2017, Washington will reach an impasse.
Iran, in the current situation, has limited the negotiations to only two expert committees. One is active and one is standby. The active expert committee is working to assess and present measures that the United States is needed to implement to be able to come back to the full compliance with the JCPOA.
Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. How could the U.S. want a mutual return while they withdrew from the deal and Iran is still part of it? It is clear that the U.S. will leave Vienna empty-handed if the outcome of the talks is anything but removal of all sanctions.
A research monitoring group on global arms sales has confirmed that the United States maintains its status as the world's biggest exporter of weapons, a title that Washington has held since the end of the Cold War. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, also referred to as SIPRI, found that between 2016 and 2020, around 47% of all U.S. arms exports went to American allies in the Middle East. That's a rise of 28% compared to the previous 5 years. In a report, it found that U.S. exports to North Africa had also witnessed a spike. Generally, global arms sales stabilized with the exception of the Middle East and North Africa. The research suggests these two destinations are lucrative markets for Western arms suppliers, despite the wars, the death and the destruction in the two regions. Analysts are left asking how Washington can talk of peace in Yemen, for example, while it is complicit in the killing of civilians there. Saudi Arabia made up 11% of the total arms import market worldwide and is the biggest importer of US, UK and Canadian arms. In February, U.S. President Joe Biden had claimed that Washington would end relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used in the kingdom's war on Yemen, which he referred to as offensive weapons. But arms controls advocates are not exactly celebrating. They are calling for more transparency. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says it's not quite clear yet where the administration will land on what weapons they deem to be offensive. The Washington-based NGO also says, "We've seen other sales that indicate the Biden administration may be staying the course on less high-profile but still very concerning arms sales." Just recently, the Biden administration had been condemned for approving a $197 million arms sale to Egypt, despite human rights concerns there. The SIPRI report also reveals that not only was the U.S. the largest exporter of weapons, but over the last 5 years, its global share of arms exports had increased from 32% to 37%. In contrast, Russian arms exports decreased by 22% during the same period. This has increased the gap between the two of the world's largest exporters of arms. The report also notes that the US had supplied major arms to 96 countries, far more than any other nation. Saudi Arabia alone accounted for 24% of all US arms sales. Analysts say conflicts such as the Saudi war on Yemen can quite easily come to an end if Washington halts its large arms exports. Critics also argue that by sending arms to conflict zones, the US has put profits for its arms manufacturing companies over the lives of innocent civilians. Project South has described SIPRI's findings as deplorable. The advocacy group says the US government specifically is willing to close its eyes on the atrocities committed by governments if they are reliable importers of US-made war-making machines. It added that, instead of supporting peace, the global north continues the colonial tradition of war-making. This also explains the lack of concrete action on the systematic human rights abuses of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Rights groups have heavily criticized America's long-standing warm ties with dictatorships in West Asia. They argue that despite these regimes waging war on other countries and despite their terrible rights record, the lucrative arms trade appears to come first for Washington. Peace advocates also argue that as the arms exports allow conflicts to drag on and on, American arms manufacturers count their ever-expanding profits over an ever-expanding list of dead women and children.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
rights defenders have expressed concern after the Biden administration announced it reached agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala for those countries to boost their deployments of military forces to stop the flow of immigrants trying to make their way to the United States. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rights Advocates Concerned Over Biden Push to Increase Militarization of Borders in Central America. Here's more on this issue. Human rights defenders have recently expressed concern after the Biden administration announced it reached agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala for those countries to boost their deployments of military forces to stop the flow of immigrants trying to make their way to the United States. I think the objective is to make it more difficult to make the journey and make crossing the borders more difficult, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said recently. Psaki said that under the agreements, which were reached over recent weeks, Mexico will keep 10,000 troops at its southern border. Guatemala upped its number of police and military personnel to its southern border with Honduras to 1,500 and will put up 12 checkpoints along the country's migratory route, she said, while Honduras surged 7,000 police and military to disperse a large contingent of migrants. Tyler Moran, Special Assistant to the President for Immigration for Domestic Policy Council, also spoke about the agreements in an interview with MSNBC. We've secured agreements for them to put more troops on their own border. Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala have all agreed to do this. That not only is going to prevent the traffickers and the smugglers and cartels that take advantage of the kids on their way here, but also to protect those children, Moran said. Dylan Corbett, executive director of the Hope Border Institute, disputed that characterization of the agreements. While ostensibly a measure against smugglers, traffickers, and cartels, this is exactly the thing. They generate more smuggling, trafficking, and cartel exploitation, and the most vulnerable will feel the brunt, tweeted Corbett, who called the development so disappointing. The other day, I met an asylum-seeking mom from Guatemala who was assaulted by the Mexican military as she and children tried to cross the border in El Paso, he added. In the mayhem, kids got to the other side and were processed as unaccompanied minors. She hasn't seen them since December. Erika Guevara Rosas, the Americas director at Amnesty International, accused Biden of repeating the mistakes of past administrations by securing agreements with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to further militarize their borders in a bid to stop people who are fleeing from state repression, violent crime, food insecurity, and the devastating effects of the climate crisis. Instead of deploying more troops, governments in the region must respect and uphold people's rights to seek asylum and live in safety, she said. The agreements to further militarize international borders in the region also drew criticism from Clara Long, associate director with the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, who tweeted that they seem to focus on deterrence rather than protection. A focus on deterrence and the coercion of other governments to collaborate with the United States on harsh measures, said Long, was a major feature of the Trump administration's policies. She called it particularly worrying that the agreements seem to focus on the continued and increased deployment of security forces with problematic human rights records. The Biden administration should place human rights at the center of its migration discussions and agreements with regional governments, Long said. The agreement comes as the United States of America saw a record number of unaccompanied children attempting to cross the border in March, and the largest number of Border Patrol encounters overall with migrants on the southern border, just under 170,000 since March 2001. According to White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, Mexico will maintain a deployment of about 10,000 troops, while Guatemala has sent 1,500 police and military personnel to its southern border, and Honduras deployed 7,000 police and military to its border to disperse a large contingent of migrants there. Guatemala will also set up 12 checkpoints along the migratory route through the country.
Around the world with reporters.
As the fasting month of Ramadan arrives, Afghans happily welcome it with honor and pride. In the meantime, poverty and low control over prices in the market by the government are major problems that poor families are facing. That is why they call on responsible bodies to take strict measures in order to control the market during the holy month.
We want businesses to think about difficulties of the poor during the fasting month of Ramadan. Government bodies also need to fully control food prices and prevent sharp price hikes during Ramadan to help poor families and individuals.
Fasting Afghans also see this month as an opportunity for not only to strengthen their bonds with God, but also to further help and support the underprivileged in society. That is one of the fundamental teachings of Islam.
This is the religious and humanitarian responsibility of every single Muslim to help poor people, especially orphans and widows who have no breadwinner, and Ramadan creates opportunities for us to fulfill our responsibility in this regard.
Besides other challenges, the COVID-19 pandemic in Afghanistan is also a problem on the way of fasting Afghans. This is because they religiously organize big gatherings during the holy month each year. The continuation of terrorist attacks and bombings during the fasting month of Ramadan is one of the other headaches for Afghans, especially for military forces who are either in the front lines or inside their posts and bases across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi announces Iran's decision to increase the level of uranium enrichment from 20 to 60% and to install an additional 1,000 centrifuges at its Natanz facility, the target of a recent act of sabotage. Araghchi broke the news upon arriving in Vienna for another joint commission meeting aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. He said the International Atomic Energy Agency has been informed.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for certain medical treatments.
Araghchi said the damaged centrifuges in Natanz would be replaced by more advanced ones, and that things would go back to normal there in the coming weeks. Signatories of the nuclear deal are expected to meet in Vienna on Thursday as negotiations continue. Iran insists that all U.S. sanctions should be lifted and their removal verified before it goes back to full compliance.
We believe that this round of negotiations is the time for the U.S. to present the list. And I hope that I can go back to Tehran with the list of sanctions which should be lifted. Otherwise, I don't believe we can continue like this. Otherwise, it would be a waste of time, actually. So let's see.
Informal discussions have already begun here with the hope of reaching an agreement on the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be lifted, after which Iran says it will discuss the verification process. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Lining up for donated clothes and a warm meal. More than 100 men who have survived Western-backed wars in the Middle East and Africa and a death-defying journey to get to the UK. A former bank employee, Keenan, is a Syrian asylum seeker living in temporary accommodation in the Welsh city of Cardiff.
I didn't leave my country in the first 5 years of the war. I left after 8 years and a half. I tried and did my level best to stay in my home country and not being a refugee. Refugee is not a good thing to be. It's not an option.
Before Cardiff, this father of one and his fellow asylum seekers had been housed in a dilapidated army barracks in the coastal village of Penali. Economics graduate Fateh worked as a risk analyst in his home country.
When I first came here, I had no idea about military camps, but we put into camps and it was a horrible experience.
The UK government says it takes the well-being of asylum seekers extremely seriously, and any abuse is completely unacceptable. But the organizer of the welcoming event in Cardiff, who has also spent a lifetime combating racism, believes the government has failed to live up to its obligation.
Without a shadow of a doubt, they failed. They failed miserably. Some of the initial accommodation is abysmal. We have seen people rehoused in shared houses where they have to share one bathroom, one kitchen with dangerous kitchen facilities.
After surviving the dangerous journey to Europe, they were greeted with this: far-right protests in Dover last year.
Here in Cardiff today, an act of kindness and compassion towards asylum seekers who come here from far and wide, from the Middle East and Africa, among them doctors and engineers. Contrast this with the kind of hostility and hate they have been receiving from some people who think that their country is under invasion by irregular immigrants.
One of the consequences of coronavirus has meant the country's already overloaded asylum application system has ground to a halt, leaving these men living a life of wait and see.
Many people have been living here in limbo, not knowing when their asylum process is going to be progressed. And of course, you have some people here who are separated from their family. They have family.
Britain remains the fifth most favorite European destination for refugees and asylum seekers, way behind Germany, France, Spain, and Greece. Keenan and other refugees and asylum seekers have survived war and the perilous voyage here, but their journey to call it their new home is yet to end. Saeed Puriza, London.
While millions of Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's continued seizure of oil ships, an Emirati oil tanker named Saga has arrived at Bir Ali port in Shabwa in eastern Yemen to transport 115,000 tons of Yemeni crude oil to the UAE.
Oil smuggling carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in southern and eastern provinces has cost Yemen more than $7 billion over the past 2 years. Annually, more than 14 million barrels of crude oil are being smuggled illegally through several ports in Shabwa province, which is under the control of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, Yemen's petroleum company says another oil tanker named Apollitaris is on its way to Deva port in Al Mukalla to move more than 300,000 tons of oil to an unknown destination.
Yemen is being systematically plundered by Saudi Arabia. An estimated $145 million of oil income is being looted monthly. Recently, an Emirati ship arrived at Shaba port to plunder 1 million barrels of crude oil, and there is another ship coming from China to transport over 2 million barrels of crude oil.
Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued detention of 10 patrol ships by Saudi Arabia, while the vessels are inspected and authorized by the UN through verification and inspection mechanism.
Yemenis say plundering their oil is an illegal act that reveals the real reasons for the years-long war on their country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was a pitch battle in garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistan's capital Islamabad. The violent clashes erupted after what protesters blamed the government to have backed out of its agreement with them to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan over the repeated incidents of public display and republication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Many died and dozens of others injured from the both sides in the clashes after the protesters blocked the major railways and road links. Protesters claimed that at least 10 of their companions were killed and over 100 were arrested by the police.
This government doesn't care about the dignity of our prophet. Obviously, people take to the streets to show their anger. We gave the government 5 months to expel the French ambassador, but they did not expel him. We will continue our protests until our demand is met, which is the expulsion of French ambassador.
Pakistan has a history of similar violent protests over the frequent incidents of blasphemy of the Prophet under the guise of freedom of expression in the West. Protecting the honor of the Prophet is the most sensitive issue in Pakistan, which attracted millions of people on the roads in the past.
Sending the French ambassador back may be a kind of a step which again could provide an immediate relief as far as the domestic political scene is concerned, but that is not going to solve the problem. Today it is France, tomorrow it will be another country. And so we need to be having a comprehensive campaign.
Pakistan has been under pressure from Paris-based anti-money laundering outfit, the Financial Action Task Force, which placed Pakistan on grey list few years ago on the charges of terror financing. Now Pakistan needs French support together with other countries to come out of the grey list, because of which Islamabad is reluctant to expel French ambassador. However, rising anti-French sentiments in Pakistan are leaving little option with the government but to expel French ambassador. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom, and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters, infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest, threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Wrightcraft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit Department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing, this has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Wrightcraft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. Okay.